Blog Talk Radio.
To Fast Forward Radio for October 6, 2009. Fast Forward Radio is part of the Blog Talk Radio Network. This show is an audio production of the Speculist weblog. You can find us online at www.speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T. The Speculist and Fast Forward Radio are all about the future, and we offer a positive view of the future that you're not likely to get through other media. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. Phil couldn't be with us tonight, but I've got a great co-host. She's a frequent guest on this program. She's our official Hollywood correspondent, and she's our friend. It's the incomparable P.J. Manny. How are you, P.J.?
I'm great, Stephen. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. Glad to have you on the program tonight.
And it's always a pleasure.
Manning the chat room for us tonight is our good friend, Sally Morum.
Hi there. How's everyone doing?
Oh, doing great. Her name rhymes with Forum, and that's good because she's going to be in the chat room keeping the conversation lively over there and interrupting when the good questions come in that we need to address because, frankly, our tensions might be elsewhere. So, you know, feel free to break in and let us know if something's especially good over there needs to be answered. So we appreciate you, Sally.
All right.
Okay. 2 weeks ago, we had George Dvorsky on the show. We had planned to cover two subjects, the future of human enhancement and the question of whether there's intelligent life elsewhere in the galaxy. Now, who would have guessed that might be too much to cover in an hour? Well, we tried, and we hit the first topic, and I thought it was a great show and a lot of fun. But, of course, we never got to the second topic, and so that's what we're doing tonight. Fortunately, George was game to come back, and George, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be back. Thanks for having me back so quickly.
Oh, it's great. George Dvorsky is a futurist, consultant, and award-winning blogger. He's written and spoken extensively about the impacts of cutting-edge science and technology, particularly as they pertain to the improvement of human performance and experience. He currently serves on the board of directors for the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and Humanity Plus. So we're glad to have him on the show. Well, I guess George, we should just probably launch into the discussion tonight. We're talking obviously about the search for extraterrestrials, why they're not here, and all that. I mean, so where is everybody, George?
Well, that's an awful conundrum. It's one that I've been pondering now for almost my entire life. As a teenager and someone in their 20s and 30s, always troubled by this particular question. And what really started to make me think about it a bit more concretely and to apply more of a methodology to it was when I discovered the conundrum as phrased by Enrico Fermi in what has been since known as the Fermi paradox. And what Enrico Fermi, I guess, realized back in the 50s, and this is somewhat anecdotal, but it probably is probably not too far from the truth, it was just over lunch apparently with he and his fellow colleagues, was he just suddenly blurted out, "Where is everybody?" And after they finally got him to explain what he was actually asking, he was just doing the number crunching in his head, and he realized that, you know what, there's really no good reason why we haven't heard from extraterrestrials at this point, given the size of the Milky Way, given the age of the galaxy, and given a whole number of other variables and assumptions. He basically came to the conclusion that we should have probably heard from them by now. And the it didn't really take off as a deep problem or as a profound problem for a few decades. It was reinvigorated in the late 70s with the resurgence of SETI, the whole Carl Sagan school of thinking, but more specifically the work of Hart and Tipler and some of the work that they were doing in terms of speculating about such things as von Neumann replicators. and even just getting some more number crunching, and it was really reinvigorated at that point. So for me personally, it was this sort of discussion, just to think about it and apply some more of a methodology to it in terms of trying to figure out what is going on here. Because I guess circling back to your question is, where is everybody? And the reason why that's such an awful problem is there's no real good reason why we shouldn't have heard from extraterrestrials by now. And there, as we're mentioning just before the show started, everyone seems to have their own answer to the solution. And Webb put out a book several years ago called 50 Solutions to the Fermi Paradox. And each one, not so satisfactory. And to be, you know, absolutely honest with you, I mean, there was really no good answer to explain why we haven't heard from any extraterrestrials at this point. And again, I'll just throw it back to you now in terms of maybe narrowing the question a little bit so I can be a bit more specific with my answers.
Okay. Well, I'll try. I guess I should state what, you know, my hunch is that we're probably the reason there's nobody else has shown up in spaceships is that we might be alone in the galaxy. I think there's a fair chance that intelligent life might be a pretty tough and rare thing, and so that might be the reason right there. But I mean, I guess everybody has their, you know, they have their pet solution.
That particular solution, it is thrown out there quite a bit. It is a very satisfying solution, and it certainly, at least in some camps, satisfies Occam's razor, that it is the most simplest solution, is that simply that we are the only ones out there.
Right.
But why that's not satisfying for me is because I think it violates another principle. I think that violates the Copernican principle, and the Copernicus, of course, famous for the audacious suggestion that the sun does not revolve around the Earth, but the Earth revolves around the sun. And again, the whole Copernican principle, meaning that we should apply the principle of mediocrity to many of our observations, particularly in the absence of information or some greater number of variables. So by applying the Copernican principle to our own situation here on Earth, we should not assume that humanity is anything special or unique or rare, that given, again, the scope of the galaxy and just how many stars there are, how many potentially habitable solar systems there may be out there. And, of course, what we're learning through our study of exosolar planets and what we're learning about the potential for life on other planets to exist, it becomes less and less satisfying to think that we're somehow unique. But, again, you're certainly potentially onto something with that particular solution. Many adherents of that would also cite in defense of that particular solution the rare earth hypothesis, that they would argue that we are in fact quite unique, that the variables on Earth, not just for example to spawn life, but even for that life to then advance to a phase of intelligence is extremely a complicated and very rare one, and in this case perhaps rare to the point where n equals 1 as far as the Drake equation is concerned. But it goes much deeper than that to suggest things like we have our moon is quite unique, that we happen to be, again, situated in a very unique solar system in terms of its characteristics and so on. But again, just going back to my further point, I think that the rare earth hypothesis and the suggestion that we're alone in the galaxy is, for me, it just defies my sense of probability, and it's just hard for me to accept that particular solution.
George, you just mentioned the Drake equation, and it's often talked of in parallel to the Fermi paradox. Can you tell us what it is and what you think might be right or wrong about it?
Sure. The Drake equation, and again, I have kind of a love-hate relationship with the Drake equation. I recognize the utility of it, and it certainly is important to talk about the Drake equation from time to time. And what it is, it was developed by Frank Drake a number of decades ago. He put together a formula that essentially tried to predict the number of radio-capable civilizations that are out there in the galaxy right now. And okay, you might ask yourself, if you're not familiar with the Drake equation, well, how could you possibly put together an equation that does that? Well, what he did was he basically broke down all the variables that he could think of that are requisites for this kind of intelligent life to emerge. In other words, he looked at the galaxy and he would ask, well, how many stars are there in the galaxy? And of those stars, how many of those stars could have a solar system? And of those, you know, how many of those solar systems have planets that are capable of generating life and so on? He just kept drilling further and further down the field until he came up with what was the answer equal is N, and N being, again, the number of radio-capable and radio-transmitting civilizations in the galaxy. And back in the 70s, and particularly when, again, SETI first got off the ground and people were all excited about finally, you know, thinking about a bit more seriously about the potential for extraterrestrial intelligences, a number of scientists, what were regarded back then and even still today as the contact optimists, they punched in a lot of big numbers into the equation. And by punching in a lot of big numbers, they came up with a nice big juicy answer at the end. And everything from, you know, hundreds of thousands of civilizations through to quite literally millions of civilizations. And I even believe that Carl Sagan was one of these optimists who thought there were millions of radio-capable transmitting civilizations in the Milky Way galaxy. And why I have issues with it and why the Drake equation is not going to stand the test of time, there are a number of factors. First of all, there's the sheer arbitrariness of placing numbers into the equation. Anybody, and I'm sure many of us have, can start to key in these numbers into the equation. That doesn't make your number any less valid or invalid than the next guy's. It's basically whatever hunch you have at this point, because we lack data almost for the majority of the variables that are keyed into the Drake equation. So again, the arbitrariness in general will tend to result in a rather meaningless answer. But the other problem with the Drake equation was that what he was asking was, how many Earth-like planets are out there? But he was not asking, well, but when were these Earth-like planets out there? And what the Drake equation fails to do is take a temporal look at the galaxy and its potential to foster the emergence of intelligent life. So, for example, some calculations show, and my own calculations on this matter mirror this, is that you've got a galaxy here that's about 16 billion years old, but it's been able to foster life for approximately 4.5 to 5.5 billion of those years, and that is an extreme expanse of time. And what that actually tells us here on Earth is that we're latecomers to the show here. It's actually late in the game here in terms of the potential for life to be up and running here in the Milky Way galaxy. But the Drake equation, again, doesn't really account for that. It doesn't really ask that sort of a question. I suppose it does, to a certain degree, ask the length of time that a radio-capable civilization will be transmitting, but it doesn't necessarily break it down any further over into the course of the 4.5 billion years that life may have been able to exist in the galaxy. And there are other problems with it as well. It doesn't, for example, make any kind of statement about the universe itself in terms of its composition and its own developmental stages. The universe, as we know, has not always been is not a static thing. It's a rather dynamic entity that changes quite dramatically over time, obviously right from the Big Bang through to its various initial phases, right through to its current phase, and who knows, you know, where it's headed into the future, whether it be the Big Rip or the Great Collapse, those sorts of things. But the point being is that, again, the Drake equation doesn't necessarily take those kinds of considerations into account as well. And looking at it just finally from perhaps a futuristic or a transhumanist perspective, it is somewhat myopic in its suggestion that we should only be looking for, or should only be calculating for, radio-capable civilizations. And as we know, now that as we ourselves are embarking into the digital era, that the radio window is an extremely short window, that when all is said and done, it might be 100 years, 100-year window. And given, you know, we're talking about billions of years of time that we're trying to get a handle on, that seems ridiculously short. And I could go on and on about that particular topic, but again, these are just some of the complaints I have about the Drake equation.
Well, and even a larger issue is a civilization could simply leapfrog radio waves. There's no reason why you have to foster communication
right.
like that. Forget about technology dependent, it's biologically dependent. It's beyond arbitrary. It's kind of like, to me, when I think about the Drake equation, it's kind of like, how many planets exist where there is intelligent life that really likes pizza?
Right. And again, these thinkers, again, I totally get what you're saying, and I agree with you. But what these thinkers were, it's this radio fixation that was such a part of the 50s and 60s culture.
Yes.
It was in a way such this pinnacle of, you know, human ingenuity is, wow, we're transmitting our radio signals into space, and now we can, you know, we can listen for radio signals coming from the depths of space and see if we can actually detect, you know, extraterrestrial signals. And, you know, for now, you know, I'm thinking, for example, today, what would we be excited about in terms of, you know, our level of development, and what do we think we should be looking for? These are the sorts of questions we should be asking, but I don't necessarily feel that we are appropriately asking these questions, because SETI is still listening for radio signals here in the year 2009, and they need to kind of, I think, be shaken up a little bit and start to think perhaps get outside that I think, outdated mode of analysis and surveying right now.
I want to throw in a defense for the Drake equation just real quick. I don't disagree with anything you said, George. It's just that I look at this and think, you know, the utility of the Drake equation is that it outlines our ignorance. It's our ignorance space, I guess. Here are the known unknowns. And we don't, and the fact that they're unknowns means that, you know, n is, you know, you can plug in any numbers you like, so n is therefore is going to be unknown. But here is why we don't know n, and
that's part of the love part of my love hate relationship with the Drake equation is that you're absolutely right. It really does inform scientists. Astrobiologists and astronomers and all the various subdisciplines of what we're talking about here, in a way, it's like this map that's got the data's absence. And in a way, it's an indicator to them, okay, you guys now go. You figure out what the answer to that variable is. And I don't disagree with that. I think it's important, for example, for us to make conjectures about how many life-bearing planets is the Milky Way galaxy capable of producing at, let's say, this given scope of time? And these are extremely important questions, and the Drake equation definitely, I think, is a motivating factor to help, you know, the scientists in their search for these sorts of answers to these sorts of questions.
Okay.
What I think is interesting is it actually does provide context where the Fermi paradox, in essence, gave people permission to ask. The Drake equation then gives them a context for the question, but I think the context may be a moving target.
Mm-hmm.
As we know more about,
completely.
You know,
yeah.
As we know more, the question itself, I think by definition, has to change.
That's right. Instead of asking about how long they broadcast radio, perhaps there's other questions we need to be answering.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Okay.
Definitely.
Well, George, a while back you wrote that as we continue to search for advanced ETIs and as we come to discover the absurdity of our isolation here on Earth, we may have no choice but to accept the hypothesis that advanced life does not venture out into space for whatever reason, the most likely being self-destruction. That's pretty pessimistic. That would be hard to swallow.
It is, and I hate that. Like, I hate that that's the most reasonable solution. I mean, earlier you suggested the solution that we're the only ones, and that for you, you know, perhaps it solves a certain issue where you're comfortable in terms of making such a conjecture. For me, in terms of my own sense of adhering to Occam's razor, for example, and looking at the data points and looking where we're headed as a civilization, it's hard sometimes not to be pretty grim about our potential moving into the future. And I do realize, you know, this show in particular is a great advocate for a different sort of a future, the kind that we're all very diligently working to achieve. But there are other forces at play that may undermine the kind of future that we do want to have for ourselves. And I think, for example, really what's kind of feeding part of my fears here is the emergence of apocalyptic weapons in particular. And I've spoken about this many times, how in the 1940s we came into the possession of our very first apocalyptic scale technological device in the atom bomb. And lo and behold, now as we're moving deeper into the 21st century, we're coming to realize that that's not by any means going to be the last apocalyptic device that we come into contact with. Looking into the frighteningly into the very near future, everything from molecular nanotechnology through to rather devastating, deliberately engineered plagues and pathogens, through to, of course, a malign singularity event where a super artificial intelligence could wipe out everything as we know it, humanity included. So, we have, at least from a speculative perspective, we can place a hypothesis down saying, look, we can make some predictions about our own doom in consideration of these future technologies. And that, for me, the analogy that I always put forth is spinning plates, is we are right now spinning one plate, which is the nuclear weapon. That's still and will always be forever moving forward a potential extinction risk for us. And then there's going to be a second plate that we're spinning, and then there's going to be a third one and a fourth one. And all it takes is for one of those plates to fall, and we're finished and we're done for. And I think that it's this spinning plates in perpetuity for advanced civilizations that is this untenable proposition that eventually everybody drops a plate at some point. Maybe it's the singularity point. Maybe it's the point in which they develop molecular nanotechnology, the kind that can result in global ecophagy, the so-called gray goo situation. Maybe that's the point. I don't know, but certainly these are the sorts of fears that I certainly have looking forward into the future. Kind of straying back onto the topic at hand now, and again, looking at the Fermi paradox in particular. This is what's known as the great filter argument, and it was put forward by the economist Robin Hanson. And the thing about the great filter, though, the one that gives us perhaps some pause for optimism, is we don't know if the great filter is an event that lies before us or if it's an event that we've already surpassed. So, for example, if it's an event that we've already surpassed, it might be, for example, that very first critical step for chemical reactions to become biological reactions instead, that very first critical step that caused life to emerge on Earth. For all we know, that is the great filter, and that every planet just ends up being stuck
and
in the
George, you're talking about the filter that keeps the galaxy from being full of civilizations.
Okay. I should have probably qualified that. Yeah, the great filter being the argument that there is some kind of an event or some kind of a hurdle that prevents the civilization from moving on to becoming a space-faring, you know, space-colonizing civilization. And what Robin Hanson was speculating is that we don't know whether that great filter is something that is ahead of us or something that we've already passed. If we've already passed the great filter, then that's something worth celebrating. Then really all bets are off, and we might be headed toward that, star-hopping, singularity, a tripping civilization that everybody, amongst the futurist community today, is fantasizing about. If it's ahead of us still, then obviously we're in some deep trouble. And given that no other civilization has ever surpassed it, we should not assume that we're going to pass it ourselves.
But who's to say there's a single great filter? Who's to say that there aren't a series of filters? Any one of them can catch us.
We could have a filter behind us and in front of us.
And in front of us, exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
That is true, actually. There's no reason to believe that there can't be multiple filters. But, again, ultimately, there needs to be one, though, that prevents civilizations from becoming spacefaring, again, star-colonizing civilizations, because we have yet to see that in our galaxy. You know, I'm just going to take a step back here for a second, particularly for some of those listeners who maybe a bit suspicious about my claims about the potency of the Fermi paradox. And again, just to kind of restate the problem. And basically, why it's so weird that we haven't been in contact with extraterrestrial civilizations is that we live in a, as stated already, a galaxy that is about 16 billion years old and has been able to foster a life, particularly intelligent life, for about 4 to 5 billion years. The galaxy itself is approximately 100,000 light years in diameter, of which not all of which is within the galactic habitable zone. The galactic habitable zone being that special band along the Milky Way, the circular band that's not too close to the center, where there's too much energy and too much chaos and too many radioactive events and other chaotic events, and such as supernovae and so on. And it's not too far out from the galaxy, in which there are likewise conditions not suitable for the rise of intelligent life. Now, given the size of the galaxy and given how long ago intelligence could have emerged in the galaxy, and if we assume, for example, that we have waves, colonization waves, embark on missions to colonize the entire galaxy, that the length of time in which it would take, for example, a colonization wave, assuming that they are advancing at an exponential rate, it is vastly disproportionate in terms of the age of the galaxy, meaning, which is my roundabout and convoluted way of saying, the galaxy could have been colonized many times over by now. It's that old. It's that ancient. And it's that small relative to the size of the galaxy. And this is further compounded, and again, I mentioned this earlier, the Hart-Tipler problem and that of the self-replicating von Neumann probes. You can come up with a whole bunch of, you know, von Neumann schemes, a von Neumann probe being a device that, again, driven by everything from AI and molecular nanotechnology, that basically you send one or several out into space, and it lands in a system where life can be fostered, and it replicates itself, and it basically sets up a new colony on that particular planet, and then it basically replicates itself, and it goes about its business again at an exponential rate. So it's these sorts of speculations that have given rise and given credence to the Fermi paradox as a genuine problem. So again, just to reiterate that, there's no reason for us, from the perspective of known physics and just again our common sense thinking as to what civilizations might be capable of, there's no good reason to believe that the galaxy couldn't have already been colonized many times over by now. So I kind of think I've kind of gone off thread a little bit here.
No, not at all.
I'll let you go from here then.
Oh well, Sally, I see there's something was in the something was said in the chat room about the prime directive. Is that right?
Yes, I wrote that. All Star Trek fans remember that the Federation was not supposed to mess up younger, more primitive civilizations that had not achieved warp drive yet. Here's some more interesting ones. The aliens are in black holes. The aliens are too small. We're alone. There are no aliens that already came up. And one very strange one, the aliens form a Dyson sphere-sized brain.
Okay.
And George came up with my answer. I didn't have to blab it after all. There's a short window for a radio-based civilization thanks to accelerating technology.
Right.
And I also said the Drake equation is an elegant set of guesses. That's really all it is. There's a number of other interesting comments that people have been making. We've really been sticking to the subject today.
It's a good subject, isn't it?
If I could, I'd like to address at least a couple of those points. I mean, those are all, every one is worth discussion. One, in particular, because it actually has an optimistic implication, that being the Dyson sphere. Please remind me to get back to that one. But first, I want to talk about the prime directive as a solution to the Fermi paradox. And I've heard that one many times before. The problem with that one, despite its obvious idealism, is this is the problem of what's called non-exclusivity in the Fermi discussions. Non-exclusivity meaning, sure, it sounds like a really great solution. And I could see maybe, 9 out of 10 advanced civilizations adhering to this rule or adhering to this particular reason for non-contact. But it doesn't satisfy everybody across the board. You couldn't possibly, let's say we have a million advanced civs out there that are star hopping. How could you possibly get every single one of them to adhere to the prime directive? It's just that, again, that defies logic. Secondly, again, because I'm just going to usurp the idealism here, again, suggesting that we're dealing potentially with post-singularity civs here, for seeding the galaxy with Bracewell probes, with potentially Berserker probes, or any kind of von Neumann replicator. These things I don't think have much ethics applied to them. It's just a brute force colonization wave, or whether it even be a singularity wave in the sort of way that Kurzweil and Hans Moravec speculate, that you have these bubbles of intelligence that expand outward, converting everything in its wake into computronium, or converting everything into some kind of, I guess, a form of matter or a form of being that is amenable to whatever goal the singularity mind has embarked upon. So thinking about thinking of this in terms of prime directive, then, I think seems somewhat naive and perhaps a bit simplistic, with all due respect to the person who posted that as a potential suggestion. Now, the whole issue about the Dyson sphere, and again, for those who may be unfamiliar with what a Dyson sphere is, the Dyson sphere is this idea that an advanced civilization won't actually need to travel anywhere. And I like this one because this also kind of satisfies, and when I was speaking in Chicago about this at a Transvision conference a few years ago, I didn't want to leave the audience all doom and gloom with my catastrophist scenarios. The one suggestion that I thought is also quite satisfying is the idea that advanced civilizations, they don't need to travel anywhere, that there is this localized, non-migratory existence, that they basically go into what John Smart would say, they go into inner space rather than outer space. And they would do that by creating megascale projects such as Dyson spheres, and as well Matryoshka brains, which are basically massive brains, like Jupiter brains, that have the calculation power of an entire planet or sun at its disposal, which again defies human comprehension. Basically, the analogy that I bring forth to this, trying to describe this kind of computing power, is that you could create sets of universes within our current universe. You have that kind of computational power at your disposal. So given that you could do all that, why would you go anywhere? So again, back to what a Dyson sphere is. A Dyson sphere is an absolutely massive structure that is approximately 1 AU from the sun. Why it's 1 AU from the sun is because the idea is that we would start to build, or an advanced civilization would start to build, a gigantic sphere, start emanating from its position relative from its distance from the sun. And it would be a gigantic sphere that would envelop the entire sun, and it would basically almost like be this the inner solar system would suddenly become indoors, and it would tap into all that energy as being fed through the sun, mostly to feed any computational demand that this advanced civilization would have. And why this is particularly interesting as well for me in particular, and I'm currently working on a paper with this in the kind of it's still in progress. And again, this is no secret, because a number of SETI people, particularly those SETI people that are outside of the proper SETI, is they're trying to figure out ways to detect the signatures from these sorts of Dyson spheres, that you could, through a spectrograph, be able to detect a very particular infrared signature that would indicate that a star is actually being concealed by some kind of artificial structure, in other words, a Dyson sphere. So those are, again, going back to Drake equation and our complaint about looking for radio signals. Again, instead of waiting for radio signals to come and arrive at us, we should be out there looking for, again, these sorts of signs of advanced intelligence, these sorts of mega projects, the kinds of things that we're now beginning to speculate about as a civilization that hopefully we ourselves are heading toward a singularity transition. That what would we do? And again, the whole idea of a mega scale a computer, and being able to just live at home why would we want to stay at home and live in a computer? Well, we can imagine an existence that's quite rich in experience and detail and possibilities, almost infinite sets of possibilities within a gigantic supercomputer like that, such that, again, to quote John Smart, we would not need to go into the vacuum of space, which is absolutely void of any kind of information or any kind of interest to us. And again, I know that is somewhat upsetting to those who want to become space archaeologists and get in their little saucer and fly around, you know, from star to star, but that may be the actual reality. It may be, in fact, where we're headed as a civilization.
There's no place like home.
That's right. That's right. You know, and space is dangerous. You know, it's there's a lot of unknowns out there, and we even know that from our own puny efforts to get out into our gravity well, how dangerous it is out there, and perhaps staying home, like you described it, may be certainly the safer thing and more prudent thing to do.
Well, look, you know, just even from our own human history, primary exploration, I don't care if it was from continent to continent, was unbelievably dangerous, and the odds were pretty much completely against you. We in history know the great success stories, but for all the success stories, there are many ships that disappeared, sank, etc., and it was only after it could be replicated a few times that people went, oh, okay, it's worth the risk.
Right. Can you imagine, and I think about this often, how many lives and how many expeditions it took to colonize the South Pacific with all those little islands dotted everywhere?
I lived in New Zealand, and the Maori, you know, that's part of their oral history, is talking about, you know, everyone can trace what canoe they came in on. You know, they're I think the seven canoes. And when you think about it, if you think about, you know, just a little kind of outrigger with a little sail, and you think, how... Talk about
seven canoes. It probably was 7,000 canoes.
Right. Seven made it. But when you know, I think of us searching for life in a very similar way, because it really is a needle in a haystack on one hand, but also you've got to take a shot and you've got to hit it just right. You know, there's such a margin for error of just to be out there floating on the current in the explorer's cases, or in our case, aiming in the wrong direction, aiming our dishes in the wrong direction. Just this past week, I took my kids and their friends to JPL, and we talked a lot about how they talk to our satellites. And discussing satellites like Voyager that has now left but hasn't quite passed, what's it called, the Helio?
The Oort cloud?
Not the Oort cloud. No. It's what defines inside our solar system versus interstellar space.
Okay.
And they don't know when it's going to pass. It could be today. It could be next week. It could be 2 years from now. But sometime in the very near future, they're going to pass into official interstellar space. And just communicating to them is so arduous because they're so tiny and they're so far away. And if we don't get our signals just right, we miss a lot of information. And that's where we know something is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As opposed to having no idea, really, really, where to aim it.
Well, bouncing off that, PJ, I mean, does that mean that, you know, SETI's not been successful simply because it's such a needle in the haystack problem? Or let me aim this at George. Do you think that SETI's still important? And what can they do that's productive at this point?
You know, I obviously invest a lot of time in being quite critical of SETI, but at the same time, and I think it's worth reiterating this, I am a supporter of SETI. I do believe that we should have these gigantic dishes pointed out there and us listening for radio signals, because it's just as important for us, I think, to have absence of data where we think it might be as it often is to have data. So in a way, the failure of SETI so far, because again, Frank Drake, when he first set it up in the 60s, he was quite convinced, as were a number of his colleagues, that they were going to start to pick up on extraterrestrial signals and pretty much immediately, that this was not going to take very long. It was just going to take a couple of years, or maybe even not even that, and then we were going to be all excited about, you know, contact. Well, here we are, obviously nearly 50 years later. And there's been absolutely nothing, and that's obviously a huge indicator to us that something fishy is going on, and that is not as easy as we had thought. So again, let's say, for example, that next week we do in fact get a radio signal. It's something, you know, akin to as Carl Sagan portrayed in Contact. that it's very obvious and it's very overt and we know we've made contact, that will quite clearly be a rather epochal moment in human history. And that's why we need to keep listening. Similarly, it will continue, again, the absence of the data will be likewise meaningful moving forward because we know that we're going to have to continue to question our assumptions as to what we think extraterrestrial life is doing, but also, quite importantly, it would also impact on our sense of where we're headed as a civilization as well. So I think, again, I don't think we should invest a whole lot of money and time into it, but certainly I do believe that we need to have some dishes out there that are definitely continuing to listen for radio signals. Now, that being said, it is called the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It's not called the search for radio signals from extraterrestrial intelligence, which clearly means that SETI needs to go through some reform. They need to smarten up real quick and start to talk to futurists, even talk to people at NASA, like Stephen Dick, for example, who he himself has talked about, for example, needing to change our mindset to think about a future in which we've made a digital transition. He even describes, you know, that advanced life will be digital and not biological. Again, what we've discussed perhaps is post-biological. And I know that Seth Shostak, who's the spokesperson and the bigwig there at SETI, he's kind of made some, you know, gestures in this direction, but it's been kind of fleeting and nothing very substantive to this point in time. But earlier we were describing, for example, the mega projects like Dyson Spheres. Those are the sorts of projects that have had, you know, SETI made an actual effort to look for those things and to publicize it and to draw awareness to it. It would, I think, certainly not just add to the sophistication of the search, but certainly would add to the efficacy of what they're doing. And there's a number of different things as well. There's optical SETI, for example, where there's speculation that we actually will be kind of, you know, have signals, literally light signals from advanced ETIs, very powerful laser signals that are highly directed. And I don't know, you know, but they probably send us some kind of code that we could decipher. Similarly, SETI should be, for example, looking for artificial objects in space that are calling cards, so not necessarily megastructures that are functional for an advanced civilization. But Luc Arnold, for example, a French astronomer, he has speculated, for example, that you could take, and it kind of sounds kind of science fiction-y, but he said that if an advanced civ wants to get our attention, they could build a gigantic structure, for example, that's the shape of a perfect triangle, and just have it orbit a sun. So knowing that, that even our level of technology, perhaps maybe not today, but certainly in the future, we would look into our, whether it be a spectrograph of sorts or even a powerful telescope, and suddenly we see this gigantic triangle moving across, you know, the spectrum of a sun. It's like, wait a minute here, that's clearly artificial. In other words, and again, that might be somewhat of a not a very great example, but certainly some kind of indication that there is clearly something artificial that's trying to get our attention. And again, even spectrographs, for example, you could take a very rare chemical compound that is not toxic, for example, and put it in vast quantities in the atmosphere, and knowing that through a spectrograph that another civilization would look and say it is actually physically impossible for that chemical element to exist at that, you know, that quantity in that particular environment, that the only explanation would be that there would be some kind of, again, artificial force at play there. Basically, again, the search needs to be, like I said, a bit more sophisticated, such that when we're looking out there into the heavens, that, you know, when we start to uncover things, we come up with basically one of three conclusions. One, particularly, for example, the spectrographic information or the triangle in front of the sun, we can come up with one of three different conclusions. One, our data is somehow flawed and that we need to kind of go back to our instruments and recalibrate and check it again. But that's something that we can fix and we'll know pretty much immediately if our data is incorrect. So the other two, I suppose, are a bit more profound here. The second conclusion that we can make is that our science is somehow immature or undeveloped. In other words, there are still some knowledge gaps. There are still phenomena out there that we simply do not understand and our physics cannot account for it. And that's fine, then we know that we still have some holes to fill in as well. But thirdly, it may just have to be that we have to conclude that the phenomenon that we're seeing out there that defies explanation has to have been caused by an intelligence, some kind of, whether it be an artifact of their parts of their, again, of their civilization, such as a Matryoshka brain or a Dyson sphere, or whether it be some kind of deliberate calling card or some kind of signal to us, that that's the kind of thing that we should be looking for. So to kind of answer your question, absolutely. You know, SETI is definitely very important for us, because not only is it important for us to continue the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, but again, any discovery we make will certainly have profound implications on our self-identity as a civilization and our sense to where we're headed, going into the future, for example.
Do you think that SETI's issues might be financial, that their resistance to looking at new forms of technology or new paradigms to search for might simply be an effect of a small budget?
Yes, there's no question. I think they have to be very calculated in terms of the kinds of projects that they embark upon, simply because there are real funding restrictions on them, and the kinds of funding that they can attract. And if they start to spout on about digital this and singularity that, they might start to get some pretty suspicious looks, and they may actually put their enterprise in severe jeopardy. So I don't envy them as an organization that is very sensitive to their fundraising needs, and I recognize that challenge. And it's very easy for me as a critic to kind of say, oh, you should do this and you should do that, because I'm not bound by their their budgetary constraints and their the sensitivity that they have to put forth in terms of their public relations. But ultimately, that's a challenge that they're going to have to win eventually, if they, in my opinion, if they're going to continue to be regarded as a serious scientific enterprise and not some kind of pseudoscientific, outdated and overly conservative, mode of operation.
Okay.
I'm thinking along the lines of the Dyson sphere. I suppose that a civilization would begin perhaps with something akin to what you see in the Halo game, and then build from there to create a Dyson sphere. Who knows? But I mean that. I suppose that you would start with something like that, and then build onto it.
Yes, in fact, I've thought along similar lines, that there would just be a natural extension of whatever structures we start to build out in, let's say, in our inner solar system and our outer solar system. We just start to become an outgrowth of that. And eventually it will make sense for that to be a rather massive structure that will envelop the entire inner solar system.
Okay. Well, and you were saying that there is thought on what you would see if you were looking at a star that had been enveloped. Would it be like X-rays still coming through, or what would
what you would see again through a spectrograph, and I believe it's through a spectrograph. It would not be through a telescope, but it would basically, you would receive a signal, and unfortunately I don't have the data in front of me, because I know there was a particular range in the infrared that you'd be looking for that would apparently be a strong indicator that you're looking at the signature of a sun, the light being emitted from a sun that has passed through some kind of an object that has enveloped it. And that is essentially the thinking behind this. And I know that there's been some work in North America, but I know as well there's been perhaps the best work has actually been done in Japan in regards to the search for what this is referred to as Dysonian SETI. So there's an actual science here. There's an actual methodology to this particular search. It's just been done by a bunch of hobbyists to this point in time. And I would love to see, for example, it actually be stepped up to become something at a much more sophisticated and a better funded level.
Okay. Sally, is any more comments in the chat room?
Well, we've been having quite a long discussion on a number of these things. Here are some more that I wrote down. One rather humorous one. Aliens are out there, but they're stealing our space probes. So in case you ever wondered what happened to those missing Mars space probes, now you know. The aliens are out there, but they're having budget problems.
I like
that. I believe that.
some kind of banking crisis, I'm sure.
That's right.
Well, these aliens have gone through the singularity, every one of them, as George and my idea had it, and when they're thinking and acting and taking in information a million times faster than we are, well, radio is so darn slow compared to that. It gets really boring, and so they don't care to communicate with us. So there's three more ideas for you.
Yeah, that is a valid point. And I find the probe suggestion there that they're stealing our probes and such reminded me again other considerations in terms of the Fermi paradox and why it's such a problem. And let's say, for example, that a civilization did not want to actually overtly go out and colonize the galaxy, but wanted to do something perhaps a bit more cautious and wanted to actually do something that's more in lines of communication. And again, the whole idea of just broadcasting radio signals, again, seems rather simplistic when you could consider, for example, going back to the whole von Neumann replicator idea, that instead of sending out, for example, colonization waves, you could send out what are called Bracewell probes. And again, the idea here is you would send out, you would seed the galaxy with Bracewell probes, and what essentially those probes are communication beacons. And they would basically just sit in each solar system or basically sit at whatever level of granularity you wanted across the galaxy. And they would just sit there and wait to be triggered by, let's say, a radio signal. So, for example, let's say back in the 1920s or 30s, let's say we had a Bracewell probe in our solar system, it would have been alerted to our presence as early as the early 20th century. And then it could have started to transmit signals to us or what have you. That's the whole idea behind a Bracewell probe. So, again, and because of its location, because its proximity would be so close to Earth or the planet of hopeful contact, there would be absolutely no question about the strength of the signal and how powerful it would be and how targeted it would be in terms of it us being able to pick it up. And this is a similar sort of idea that is explored in 2001, A Space Odyssey. There are probes that are lying dormant, waiting simply to be triggered by the activity of the residents of the planet that it's surveying. In the case of 2001, there was a first stage, for example, from early hominids and their ability to become a tool-bearing civilization or the tool-bearing species. That was facilitated by the uplift probe. And then similarly, moving ahead to the future, the probe also, obviously through the the wishes of whatever created it, facilitated the next phase of transition for the human species as our main character, David, transitioned from a human to the so-called star child. So again, those are different kinds of ideas that feed into this particular discussion. So there's some knowns and unknowns there. Maybe, for all we know, there are these sorts of probes lying dormant in our solar system just waiting for us to do something to trigger it. Which also kind of gives rise to a more, I guess, foreboding possibility, and that is the whole idea of berserker probes. And the berserker probe is a similar kind of a probe, but what it does, it simply goes out and destroys everything in its wake. So, again, either it could just simply, a civilization could, just as easily as it could colonize a galaxy, it could actually sterilize a galaxy in the same amount of time, probably actually be a lot easier and quicker. As we know, it's much easier to destroy than it is to create. So again, using the same kind of paradigm of self-replication, the galaxy could have been sterilized many times over by now, but clearly it's not, because we're here right now having a great conversation over Fast Forward Radio describing Bracewell probes and berserker probes, and obviously I think by virtue of that kind of acknowledgement, we can conclude that there are no berserker probes currently loose in the galaxy, and I think that's obviously a good thing. But similarly, you could also have berserker probes sitting in the solar system, waiting to be triggered by, let's say, a radio signal. But if that was the case, it should have been triggered, some 80, 90 years ago. And if it's going to destroy us, it better get moving because we're quickly heading toward at least potentially a singularity point, in which case we'll maybe be able to defend ourselves against such a thing. I don't know. Obviously,
unless there's
heavy
just
speculation now.
Yeah.
Go ahead, PJ.
I was going to say, unless there's an interstellar highway project that needs some space to be built. Sorry, that's a Hitchhiker's Guide joke for those who don't know.
I have a feeling that everyone, I think, in this particular audience will probably pick up.
Probably got it, exactly.
That's right. You aim that joke at the right place. That's awesome. Well, we got maybe time for maybe one more question. PJ, chat room, Sally, y'all have anything else?
I have a question that I just wrote down.
Okay.
Could those aliens detect the emerging singularity on a life-bearing planet?
This is I had an amazing conversation a number of years ago with Anders Sandberg, the Swedish polymath, and Eliezer Yudkowsky, the AI theorist, and because we were trying to come up with again our own theories as to what's going on with the Fermi paradox, and one of the learnings that came out of our conversation, and then we never really developed this idea any further, and I wish we had. Was that there actually may be not just one type of a singularity or one type of a survivable singularity, but there may be a multitude of types, and not all types are equal. There are going to be different mind spaces or SAI mind spaces that emerge from particular singularities, and it may be impossible to predict the kinds that will emerge from different civilizations. Some of these may be benign, but some of them may also be malign, and that there actually may be some kind of interstellar policing force. Again, this is kind of combining a whole bunch of different ideas, but basically a post-singularity policing force that is actually surveying each civilization and basically assessing the quality of its singularity and the kind of mind space that emerges from it. And at that point, we'll decide whether to snuff it out or not, or to let it, again, foster and then join their forces together with this interstellar, you know, benign, this singularity mind space. And again, these are the kinds of conversations we had. So that may be, in fact, the case that maybe one of the reasons why, for example, we haven't made contact yet. But again, that defies a lot of the things that I was describing earlier about colonization and other such factors. This is also kind of peripherally what is regarded as the zoo hypothesis. You'll hear this one a lot, that the reason why we haven't made contact yet is because they're just simply out there observing us, somewhat related to the prime directive. But there's less of, an ethical component here. It's more of them being curious about us and observing us from a distance and not wanting to kind of get involved with what we're doing, kind of keep us on a short leash just through observation. And again, the problem with that particular scenario is the non-exclusivity of it, is that, sure, you could maybe have one or two civilizations that are happy to observe us from a distance, but that doesn't guarantee that every single civilization that emerges in the galaxy is going to have the same sort of idea.
That's going to have to be it, George. We've had a good time. An hour passes so fast when you're talking about something interesting like this, doesn't it?
It really does. We covered a lot, though, I think.
Yeah, I think we did pretty good. Pat ourselves on the back for that. PJ, thank you. Sally, thank you. Everyone in the chat room. We have some interesting music tonight, and this is, the first time that a guest on the show has actually contributed to what the music is playing. George, you may not know it. This is A Glorious Dawn.
Nice.
With Carl Sagan and Stephen Hawking, arranged by John Boswell. And it's pretty weird, but once you've heard it once, you can't hear it. You can't get enough of it. It's sort of you'll be brain farmed, and courtesy of Fast Forward Radio. So, anyway, good night to everyone.
Good night, everybody. Thanks for having me once again.
I'm not very good at singing songs, but here's a try. From scratch, you must first invent the universe. Space is filled with a network of wormholes. You might emerge somewhere else in space, somewhere else in time. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns, or the rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full
I believe our future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. But the brain does much more than just recollect. It compares, synthesizes, analyzes, it generates abstractions. The simplest thought, like the concept of the number one, has an elaborate logical underpinning. The brain has its own language for testing the structure and consistency of the world. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rose, a morning filled with 400 billion suns, the rising of the Milky Way. The sky calls to us. If we do not destroy ourselves, we will one day venture to the stars.
For thousands of years, people have wondered about the universe. Did it stretch out forever, or was there a limit? From the Big Bang to black holes, from dark matter to a possible Big Crunch, our image of the universe today is full of strange-sounding ideas.
How lucky we are to live in this time, the first moment in human history when we are, in fact, visiting other worlds. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way.
The surface of the Earth is the shore of the cosmic ocean. Recently, we've waded a little way up, and the water seems inviting.